We live in a corporate world that is just completely obsessed with storytelling right
Oh,
now.
totally. Storytelling, emotional connection, vulnerability, all of that.
Exactly. But there is this 14% sliver of the population who thinks your inspiring personal anecdote is, well, completely useless.
Right. They just do not care.
Yeah, I mean, picture this. You walk into a conference room, your energy is super high, and you deliver this passionate pitch painting a beautiful picture of the future.
And you're fully expecting a round of applause.
Exactly. You finish, and instead of clapping, one colleague leans forward, totally ignores the emotional narrative arc, and just points out a single microscopic logical flaw in your spreadsheet.
It's the worst feeling. Because to them, a touching story in a business meeting doesn't just fall flat, it actually feels like an active attempt to manipulate the data.
Wow, so they think you're hiding something.
Yeah, or masking a really weak argument. They aren't moved by your passion, they are highly suspicious of it.
Which is incredibly jarring for the rest of us. It feels like they completely missed the forest because they were, aggressively inspecting the bark on one specific tree.
That is a perfect way to put it.
And so that's the mission of today's deep dive. We are entirely focused on understanding the mental machinery of that specific colleague.
Whether we all have one.
Oh, absolutely. We are decoding how to effectively communicate with the highly analytical, sometimes negative, critical personality type.
Right, because as much as they might stall a freewheeling brainstorming session, they are the people who actually keep our organizations functioning.
Spot on. And for context, we are grounding this exploration in the behavioral framework created by Nancy Roberts, who is famously known as the DIC wizard.
DISC. It's a foundational system that categorizes how people naturally behave, process information, and communicate.
Right. And if you want to stop hitting a brick wall in your professional life or your personal life, honestly, understanding this framework is a total prerequisite.
It really is.
So let's briefly define that architecture for you listening. DISC is an acronym. It stands for Dominance, Influence, Steadiness, and the specific focus of our deep dive today, compliance.
And we really need to clear up a massive misconception about that right out of the gate.
Oh, yeah, the C word.
Exactly. People often assume the C stands for conscientiousness. But in this specific framework, it is strictly compliance.
Wait, does that distinction actually matter that much?
It changes everything. You see, conscientious usually implies someone who works hard, remembers your birthday, maybe stays late to help clean up the office.
Like a really considerate team player.
Right. But compliance in this behavioral model has nothing to do with social graces. None at all.
Okay, so what does it mean?
It means strict adherence to logic, objective reality rules, and exceedingly high operational standards.
Wow.
Yeah, they comply with the facts, regardless of whose feelings get hurt in the process.
Gotcha. So it isn't about being a good employee in that warm, collaborative sense. It's about this deep psychological allegiance to accuracy. Well, if their primary allegiance is to logic, I would assume they naturally gravitate away from fields that require a lot of emotional intuition, right? Do the demographics back that up?
Oh, they absolutely do. When we look at the numbers, only about 14% of the general population naturally falls into this critical or compliance category.
Just 14%. That's fairly small.
It is, but they do not distribute evenly across society.
Yeah.
You will find them highly concentrated in professions that view ambiguity as a dangerous liability.
Oh, I see where this is going. Like accounting.
Accounting, engineering, information technology, quality assurance, medical research.
Right, fields where mistakes have huge consequences.
Precisely. In a room full of software engineers who are testing flight navigation systems, that 14% might look more like 70 or 80%.
Which honestly is exactly what you want. I mean, if someone is writing the code for a commercial airliner's autopilot, a close enough mentality is completely terrifying.
Right. We demand exactness from them.
Yeah, we absolutely do.
And their core traits really reflect that demand. They are naturally cautious, restrained, and precise.
Glad.
But because they hold themselves to such an unforgiving standard of accuracy, they naturally apply that exact same metric to everyone around them.
Oh man, I can see how that causes problems.
Yeah, the friction arises because these traits often project outward to the rest of the world as stern, negative, and relentlessly pessimistic.
Right, they just seem like a downer. The best way I can visualize this dynamic is to think of a human building inspector.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, think about it. When you hire a building inspector for a house you're about to buy, their function isn't to walk through the front door, admire the aesthetic of the wallpaper, and compliment the natural light.
Right, you're not paying them for interior design tips.
Exactly. Their entire purpose, the whole reason they exist in that transaction, is to actively hunt for the hidden crack in the foundation.
Yes.
If they walk out saying everything is perfect, you actually suspect they didn't do their job.
That analogy perfectly captures their internal motivation. Yeah, because the psychological reward for a compliance type doesn't come from celebrating what works. Mm. It comes from mitigating risk by finding what's broken.
Wow, okay.
But to the other 86% of the population, someone who is constantly pointing out flaws feels like a personal attack.
It feels super malicious.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But our source material highlights this brilliant quote from the writer David Rakoff that reframes this entirely.
Oh, what's the quote?
He noted, "Optimism is broad-based thinking. Pessimism is detail-oriented thinking."
Oh, wow. Pessimism is detail-oriented thinking.
Yeah.
So we are just totally misinterpreting their cognitive process as an emotional state.
That's not on.
When they point out the flaw in, say, a marketing budget, they aren't trying to destroy the team's joy. They are just zooming in on the micro-level details while the rest of the room is still looking at the broad-based vision.
Right. They possess this mechanical need to find what's missing. And removing the assumption of personal malice is really step one in communicating with them. If you assume they are just being negative to ruin your day, you'll approach them defensively, and the conversation is basically over before it begins.
Makes sense. But wait, that detail orientation is exactly why the modern playbook of winning hearts and minds just blows up in our faces, isn't it?
Oh, completely.
Because if we go back to that conference room pitch we talked about at the beginning, modern communication advice dictates that you must tell a compelling, vulnerable story.
Right. Use a narrative arc to build consensus.
Exactly. But if they're just scanning for foundational cracks, a story isn't going to help.
Relying on a story is actually the number one mistake people make with critical types.
Wait, the number one mistake? Really?
Yes. Because if you lean on emotion, personal persuasion, gut feelings, or intuition, you are instantly signaling to a compliance type that you do not have the data to back up your claims.
Oh, I see. So they view a subjective narrative not just as irrelevant, but as actively suspicious.
Think about it from their perspective. A personal story is just an anecdote with a sample size of one.
Right. That's true.
It is completely unverifiable.
Yeah.
If you tell them, hey, I just have a really great gut feeling about this new strategy, my intuition says it's going to resonate, their mental machinery categorizes that as flawed evidence.
Because intuition can't be put into a spreadsheet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Intuition cannot be stress tested. They trade strictly in the currency of tangible facts, statistics, and objective reasoning.
Wow, that explains so much. It explains why so many cross-departmental meetings feel like two groups speaking completely different languages.
Yes.
You know, the sales team is trying to inspire everyone, and the IT team is just staring at them blankly because inspiration doesn't compile in a code base.
Exactly. It just doesn't compute.
But if they operate purely on objective facts, they must be incredibly rigid. Does that mean they hold everyone else to these impossible black and white standards?
Well, it creates a really fascinating paradox in their personality. We can call it the judgment contradiction.
Okay, the judgment contradiction. Break that down for me.
So, because they view the world through the lens of verifiable facts, they genuinely believe there is an objectively correct way to do things and an incorrect way.
Right. Very binary.
Which makes them highly prone to pointing out errors, complaining when protocols aren't followed, and criticizing others. They can very easily come across as judgmental or intellectually superior.
Oh, yeah. We can all picture that specific colleague who seems to find a grim satisfaction in CCing the entire department when someone makes a minor formatting error.
Yes, exactly that guy.
So what is the contradiction part?
The contradiction is that despite freely criticizing the flaws of everyone else, they are incredibly sensitive to criticism themselves.
Wait, really?
Oh, yeah. They will put up massive walls of resistance if an outside source suggests an area where they could improve.
That feels like a glaring double standard. I mean, if someone's entire identity is built around logic and objective improvement, shouldn't they welcome feedback that helps them get better?
It seems totally illogical until you look at how they construct their self-worth.
Okay, how so?
Well, for most people, self-worth might be tied to being liked or maybe being creative.
Sure.
For compliance type, their identity is entirely anchored in their core competency and their accuracy.
Ah, so their work is their worth.
Yes. They have already agonized over their own work, stress testing every variable before even presenting it.
Okay.
So when you offer a casual critique, it doesn't register as a helpful tip. It registers as a direct assault on their intellect and their value. They just assume your criticism must be unfounded because they already done the math.
Wow. That is a treacherous landscape to navigate.
It really is.
So we have a colleague who demands objective data over emotional appeals, freely criticizes others based on rigid standards, yet interprets any criticism of their own work as a direct intellectual attack.
Correct.
So if I have a crucial meeting tomorrow with a 14 percenter and I desperately need their approval on a project, how do I physically alter my approach? Like, what are the tactical parameters here?
The tactical rulebook requires a complete shift in presentation. Let's look at the do checklist first.
Okay, what do I do?
Your demeanor must be rational, serious, and direct. You must prepare your case meticulously in advance. There is absolutely no room for winging it or thinking out loud in front of them.
Because thinking out loud implies you haven't finalized the data, which triggers their anxiety about ambiguity.
Precisely. You have to bring specific data. Yeah. If you are making a bold claim, you cannot rely on your own authority.
Right, because my intuition means nothing.
Exactly. You need testimonials or reports from respected, verifiable third-party sources. You must also focus heavily on under-promising and over-delivering.
Okay, let's pause there. Most people view under-promising as just a smart expectation management trick. But for a compliance type, is over-promising actually viewed as a lie?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
If you say a project will increase revenue by 20% and it only increases by 15%, a normal person might celebrate the 15% gain.
Right, a win is a win.
Not to them. The critical person will fixate on the 5% deficit. To them, you provided inaccurate data. You failed the precision test.
Ouch.
This is why you must provide concrete action plans. They want to see scheduled dates, milestones, and highly measurable outcomes.
So they want the actual blueprint, not just the artist's rendering.
Exactly. And crucially, once you hand them the blueprint, you have to allow them physical and temporal space. Provide the information, and then back off.
Wait, why is the space so important? Are they just introverted?
It's not necessarily about introversion at all. It's about processing time.
Okay.
They need temporal space to independently verify the claims you just made. If you hover over them demanding immediate feedback, you are interrupting their verification process.
Oh, man. So preparing for this interaction sounds less like grabbing a coffee to bat around some ideas and much more like preparing a rigorous legal brief for a Supreme Court justice.
That is exactly what it's like.
You present the evidence, set your precedents, and step back from the bench.
Right. Which leads us to the don't checklist.
Yeah, what behaviors immediately destroy credibility?
Absolutely no touchy-feely behavior. This personality style prefers to maintain professional distance.
So no big hugs.
Definitely not. Public displays of affection, overly familiar backslapping, or, you know, launching into a deeply personal story about your weekend plans right out of the gate makes them deeply uncomfortable.
Because you are introducing unpredictable emotional variables into a professional environment.
Exactly.
So I should just skip the mandatory 10 minutes of small talk about the weather and get straight to the agenda.
Please.
But what about physical presentation? Does the way I organize my materials matter as much as the data itself?
Oh, immensely. To a compliance type, external order is a direct reflection of internal logic.
Really?
Yeah. If you walk into a meeting flustered, with a chaotic stack of papers falling out of an unzipped folder, their brain immediately links physical chaos to intellectual chaos.
Oh, no.
Before you have even opened your mouth, they have deduced that your data is as messy as your briefcase.
That is a brutal initial judgment, but honestly, it tracks perfectly with their need for control.
It does. Furthermore, never force a quick decision. Do not use sales-style closes or artificial deadlines to pressure them.
Because they hate being rushed.
Remember, their core trait is caution. Forcing them to rush doesn't create urgency. It creates suspicion. They will just assume you are artificially accelerating the timeline to prevent them from finding the flaw in your proposal.
Man, they are constantly on guard.
Always.
So all of this assumes we are just presenting information for them to evaluate. But what happens when we hit a wall of active resistance?
That is where it gets tricky.
Right. What if I present my meticulously organized data, give them time to process it, and we just fundamentally disagree on the path forward? If I know their conclusion is wrong, just conceding feels like a total dereliction of duty.
And it would be. But this is where advanced tactics are required, because the golden rule for handling disagreement with a compliance type is really counterintuitive.
Okay, what's the rule?
Do not disagree with them directly.
Wait, if I can't tell them they are wrong, how do I correct the course?
Well, if you confront them directly and state that their conclusion is incorrect, you instantly trigger the judgment contradiction we discussed earlier.
Right. Because they view themselves as purely objective.
Yes. Telling them they are wrong is equivalent to calling them irrational. They will dig their heels in, the defensive walls go up, and the negotiation is over.
So what's the alternative?
Instead, you use a workaround we can call the narrow-minded loophole.
The narrow-minded loophole. I like the sound of that. How does it work?
Instead of declaring them wrong, you ask a very specific, carefully phrased question. You ask, is it possible there is a different interpretation of this data? Or could we look at this specific variable from an alternative perspective?
Okay, so by phrasing it as a question about possibility, I'm not actually attacking their conclusion. I'm just introducing a new variable.
Exactly.
But why does that change their mind?
Because it exploits their deepest professional fear.
Which is?
Critical people secretly fear being perceived as narrow-minded or biased.
How fascinating.
Right. Their entire self-worth is built on the idea that they evaluate all the facts impartially. So by gently questioning if an alternative interpretation is merely possible, you challenge their objectivity.
Wow.
And more often than not, they will take on the burden of exploring that alternative perspective themselves, just to prove to you that they are capable of being perfectly unbiased.
That is incredible psychological jujitsu. You aren't pushing them across the finish line at all. You are simply opening a door and letting their own compulsive need to be perfectly analytical walk them right through it.
It is highly, highly effective. However, there are times when even the loophole fails.
Of course there are.
Yeah. When a critical person becomes completely entrenched in their pessimism and absolutely refuses to move forward, Nancy Roberts utilizes a highly advanced coaching strategy. She calls it as an azange, the conversation.
As ising, huh. The phrase makes me think of buying a used car as is. You know, meaning you just accept all the broken parts and flaws. Is she suggesting we just give up and accept their resistance?
No, it is actually the exact opposite. It has nothing to do with accepting flaws.
Okay, then what does it mean?
Think of as-ising as holding up a completely objective, distortion-free mirror to the present moment. You state the situation exactly as it is occurring in real time, removing all emotion from the observation.
Okay.
Nancy uses this when she is hired to coach executives with this personality type. They will claim they want her help, but then mechanically resist every single strategy she offers.
So how does she hold up the mirror?
She will bluntly as-is the dynamic. She will literally say, I do not think I can help you achieve your goals because of your complete lack of willingness to consider new possibilities.
Whoa.
But the crucial step is what follows. She immediately provides specific objective examples of their resistance.
Okay, I have a major concern with this tactic.
What's that?
We just spent 20 minutes outlining how incredibly sensitive these individuals are to criticism. Isn't it a massive risk to sit across from them and brutally declare you are impossible to help? Won't that trigger a total meltdown?
It is a calculated risk, but the mechanism behind it is entirely data-driven.
Ah, so?
If you sit down and say you are being stubborn and difficult, you are attacking them with an emotional opinion. They will immediately reject it.
Right.
But if you state the dynamic as an objective equation, like, I cannot achieve goal X because behavior Y is actively occurring, and you back behavior Y up with concrete timestamps and examples, you completely bypass their emotional defense system.
Because you are appealing directly to their logical side.
Exactly. You aren't judging their soul. You are feeding them hard data about their own behavioral bottleneck.
Oh, I see. You present their own resistance as a factual roadblock to organizational efficiency.
Yes. It jolts them out of their negative loop because they pride themselves on being efficient.
That makes total sense.
This usually forces them to become temporarily open-minded just to solve the newly identified inefficiency in their own communication. It buys you a brief window of openness to introduce your ideas.
You know, this completely shifts how we need to view these interactions. We typically view this personality type as an annoying, pessimistic roadblock to progress. But understanding their mental machinery reveals that they are actually the essential, detail-oriented protectors of our foundations.
They really are. Which means the theory is only useful if it alters your behavior. Knowledge of this framework doesn't actually solve the problem unless it is applied in the real world.
So for you listening right now, the challenge is to build your own action plan. Mentally scan your workplace, your social circle, or your family, and identify the 14 percenters in your life.
Find them.
Right. Who is the person constantly looking for the crack in the foundation? Map out the specific communication failures you've had with them in the past, and decide which of these tactical shifts you will deploy tomorrow.
Exactly. Will you ditch the emotional storytelling?
Right. Will you organize your physical workspace before pitching them? Will you use the narrow-minded loophole to bypass their defenses?
The broader impact of doing this work really cannot be overstated, especially in a corporate environment.
Definitely.
There's a quote in our source material from the author John Ortberg that highlights the stakes here. He writes, "Both hope and pessimism are deeply contagious, and no one is more infectious than a leader."
Wow. So if a 14-percenter is sitting in a leadership role, their detail-oriented pessimism can either infect an entire department with a paralyzing fear of failure, or if we learn how to feed them the data they need, that exact same trait can infect the team with an unstoppable drive for excellence.
Bridging that communication gap dictates which contagion spreads.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you to mull over.
Right.
We established that only 14% of the population possesses this highly analytical, compliance-driven mindset.
A very distinct minority.
Exactly. Yet they are the exact people whose unforgiving standards and obsession with accuracy keep our bridges from collapsing, our commercial flights in the air, and our financial systems from burning to the ground.
That's true.
So if they are doing all of that heavy lifting to keep society functioning safely, is it actually the 86% of us who need to learn how to speak their language rather than constantly expecting them to warm up and adapt to ours?
Something to think about.
The next time you are in a conference room and that specific colleague pops your metaphorical balloon, well, you might want to thank them for pointing out the leak before you tried to fly it.